The following closed-circuit advisory is not necessarily for air. With some words about our new website presence and the latest from the Newsline Support Fund, here's our producer, Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF.
By now, you've probably noticed that amateur radio Newsline has a new look on the World Wide Web. Candidly, this was not planned, but came about because our old web host notified us that they were leaving the shared server web hosting business by the end of February. We had to act fast, and thanks to three people, Robert Sudock, WB6FDF, Dale Carey, WD0AKO, and Kevin Trotman, N5PRE, the move was accomplished in less than 2 weeks. For this, I thank them very much. But the move was not without financial cost to Amateur Radio Newsline. We had thought we'd be okay through the end of May, but that's no longer the case. So we are coming to you a bit earlier to ask for your assistance in keeping these newscasts on the air. You can make a donation online by clicking the PayPal button on our website homepage or by sending a donation to the address you will hear at the end of this week's newscast. Either way, we at the Amateur Radio Newsline thank you very much for your ongoing support. I'm Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF. Now, this week's newscast.
Thank you, Bill. Now, Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1803, with a release date of Friday, March 2nd, 2012, to follow in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. The following is a QST. Bad batteries may have led to the loss of communications of a ham radio balloon from Texas to China. Also, Australia begins an evaluation program to see if its hams should be granted a power increase to a full kilowatt. Hams in Senegal to get access to 6 meters. MV Island is deleted from the DXCC, and the role of social media in times of emergency reporting. All this and more on Amateur Radio Newsline Report number 1803, coming your way right now.
From around the world, this is Newsline, Amateur Radio's independent on-the-air news and bulletin service. Now, here is Jim Davis, W2JKD.
Failure of the batteries that powered the ham radio payload of a high-altitude balloon that was designed to float from Texas to China seems the likely cause of a total communications failure with the Near Space Project. Amateur Radio Newsline's Heather Butera Howell, KB3TZD, is here with the rest of the story.
The South Texas Balloon Launch Team lofted the high-altitude scientific balloon experiment, known as BLT-28, on February 11th from near Katy, Texas. The balloon was supposed to rise to over 100,000 feet and float for several days, hopefully reaching its target of Nanjing, China. But, as reported here on Newsline, contact was lost with the balloon's APRS tracker just south of the Louisiana coastline at an altitude of 45,763 feet. Andrew McAllister, W5ACM, is part of the group that launched BLT-28. In a note to Lloyd Colson, KC5FM, that was forwarded to Newsline, McAllister says that right now the highest probable failure mode was the batteries that powered the electronics payload. W5ACM notes that the power supply was made up of commercial 1.5-volt lithium cells. According to post-flight experiments, McAllister says that several of the same type of batteries were put directly on some dry ice, where they went from 1.5 volts down to 2/10 of a volt, and when warmed up, they did not return to normal output. McAllister speculates that it could have been just that cold after the reception of the last packet message from BLT-28. He notes that the temperature sensor system was not guaranteed below minus 40 degrees Celsius. McAllister confirms that there will be a second attempt to float a balloon from Texas to China, but first up will be a test flight of the thermal insulating system for the batteries and the payload. W5ACM speculates this should happen sometime in May. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Heather Butera Howell near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
W5ACM indicates that if all goes well in May, that another attempt to fly a balloon from the United States to China could happen before year's end. Advanced class ham radio operators in Australia are being invited to take part in a study to see if it's possible to raise the power limit down under to a full kilowatt. This, as the Australian Communications and Media Authority, better known as the ACMA, publishes details of the trial of higher power transmitter outputs on its website. Michael Owen, VK3KI, is the president of the Wireless Institute of Australia.
The trial will commence on the 1st of March, and will continue until the 31st of August 2013. The ACMA has advised the WIA that the 18-month authorization is intended to provide the ACMA with time to evaluate the success of the trial after a 12-month period and to consider permanent regulatory arrangements, if warranted, while avoiding dead air between the evaluation time and the implementation of permanent arrangements, if appropriate. The paper is in the part of the ACMA site dealing with amateur matters and is an information paper. A brief article also appears on the Engage part of the ACMA website where anyone can record their comments.
The Wireless Institute of Australia Board of Directors has cautioned those hams considering obtaining a higher power permit that this is only a trial. As such, if problems do emerge, it could affect whether amateurs down under will permanently continue to be able to use the higher power, in particular, if interference is caused to others. The WIA advises that the VK radio amateurs involved must immediately do whatever it takes to stop the interference and must resolve the problem. 6 meters is coming to Senegal. This with the word from the National Ham Radio Society that following its application to the Regulatory Agency for Telecommunications and Posts, the band of 50 to 51 megahertz has been officially allocated to that nation's amateur service on a primary basis. Now, this allocation becomes effective when the new ITU radio regulations come into force. Therefore, any contacts made on 6 meters before that date have to be considered as unauthorized. As of February the 17th, Malij Visočki Island, better known as MV Island, in ham radio circles, has been deleted from the DXCC. This after the announcement by the Finnish Ministry of Transportation and Communications that the Saimaa Canal Treaty between Finland and Russia has been finalized and that MV Island is no longer included in it. For amateur radio, this means that MV Island was deleted from the DXCC and added to the deleted entries list. Also that the entry level for DXCC honor roll number has dropped to 331. We'll have more DX news later on in this week's newscast. With new privileges on the 60-meter band beginning March the 5th, the ARRL announced some new recommended practices for operating on that band. These new suggestions are based on survey results and subsequent research. The committee evaluating the new 60-meter rules declined to propose a specific band plan at this time, but instead created a recommended practices document now available in PDF format at tinyurl.com/ARRL-60 meters. Also look for the April issue of QST Magazine to include an article by ARRL Regulatory Information Manager Dan Henderson, W1ND. It'll offer a detailed discussion of the new 60-meter privileges and recommend operating practices for that band. ARISS Operation Team Mentor Charlie Sufana, AJ9N, reports that the total number of amateur radio on the International Space Station, or ARISS-sponsored ISS-to-Earth school events, has passed the 700 mark. The 700th school contact was with the Academy of Shawnee City in Louisville, Kentucky. It took place via telebridge with ON4ISS on February the 14th. The special John Glenn event to commemorate the 50th anniversary of Perth, Australia's City of Lights on February the 20th marked event number 701. For those hams not aware, ARISS offers an opportunity for students in schoolrooms to experience the excitement of amateur radio by talking directly with crew members on board the International Space Station. Further information on the ARIS program is available at www.ariss.org. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline. Heard on bulletin stations around the world, including the N5YYU repeater serving Clinton, Arkansas. Emergency Management Without Social Media, Fail, is the title of a very interesting op-ed article by author Tim Burrows, posted across several social media websites. In it, Burrows looks at both the positive and the negative effects on the public that social media can have in accurately disseminating and updating information of a disaster, accident, or other event that the public needs to know. Amateur Radio Newsline's Norm Seeley, KI7UP, has more.
The scenario Tim Burrows writes about involves a railroad accident that took place on February 26th. That's when a Via Rail Canada train en route from Niagara Falls to Toronto was involved in a derailment that occurred in the Burlington, Ontario area. Official news reports say the three engineers riding in the cab of the locomotive were killed. There were no fatalities among the 75 passengers, but 45 were injured. Burroughs' article details the role of the mass media along with the self-involvement of individuals in putting out news bulletins regarding the accident, many of which were not properly vetted before being released into cyberspace. He notes that while there was an incredible amount of information flying around, there was no voice of authority speaking. He also takes note that official media sources were also quoting unsubstantiated sources, such as one outlet that quoted an emergency agency from another jurisdiction. On the other hand, Burroughs praised several VIA Rail employees who used Twitter to keep accurate information flowing of the accident, even though they were being chided at on Twitter because the system suffered delays. Burroughs says that even though they had just lost three members of their working family, they answered everyone professionally and systematically. For Amateur Radio Newsline, Norm Seeley, KI7UP in Scottsdale, Arizona.
Whether you agree or disagree with Burroughs' assessment of the role of social media in regards to the accuracy of the information being made public, his article is a very interesting evaluation for anyone involved in the world of emergency communications, this being especially true during events where no official JIC or Joint Information Center is available. You can read the entire story online, tinyurl.com/emergency-social-media. Yet another city has discovered the value of having trained ham radio operators as a part of its emergency communications plan. This as community leaders in Arlington, Massachusetts announced that they're seeking radio amateurs willing to help the town with its emergency response network. In a statement issued to the press, officials say that they're looking for ham radio operators to become volunteers to help out in case the town's emergency communication system was to stop working. Arlington used a grant from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to buy a ham radio gear for emergencies. Any Massachusetts ham living in the area who is interested in volunteering should contact Fire Chief Robert Jefferson by email to rjefferson@town.arlington.ma.us. The FCC has issued a $20,000 notice of apparent liability for monetary forfeiture to Florida resident Rubens Chizera. This for operating an illegal unlicensed radio transmitter on the frequency of 107.3 from his residence in West Palm Beach. In this case, the FCC says that it received an interference complaint from the Federal Aviation Administration about illegal transmissions reported by its control tower at the Palm Beach International Airport. The FCC traced the transmission on 107.3 to Chizera's residence and said they saw an FM transmitter connected by coax to the transmitting antenna. Chizera admitted operating the station for about a month. He said he knew it was illegal, and on the night when the airport experienced interference, Chizera told agents he had broadcast a party from his home. Also, Mercius Dorvalis received a base fine of $10,000 for operating a station illegally on 92.7 megahertz in Pompano Beach, Florida. He told a detective from the Broward County Sheriff's Office that he bought and installed the gear in his rented room and that he was responsible for operating the transmitter. The FCC, citing Florida business records, said Dorvilius is doing business as Radio Vision FM 92.7 Inc. and has registered the domain name www.visionfm.org. Both Chizera and Dorvilius were given the customary 30 days from the date of the issuance of the fines to either pay up or to file an appeal. The FCC has again slapped the hand of telemarketers to further protect consumers from unwanted auto-dialed or pre-recorded calls, often referred to as robocalls. On February the 15th, the Federal Communications Commission approved changes to its telemarketing rules to combat unwanted telemarketing calls and texts, which were consistently in the top three consumer complaint categories at the FCC in 2011. The FCC says that robocalls invade customers' privacy and can, in the case of calls to wireless customers, use up their minutes. The new rules reduce regulatory uncertainty with minimal burdens on the industry and maximize consistency with those of the Federal Trade Commission. Specifically, the rules protect customers by requiring telemarketers to obtain prior express written consent from them, including by electronic means such as the website form before placing a robocall to a consumer. The new rules also require that telemarketers provide an automated interactive opt-out mechanism during each robocall so the consumers can immediately tell the marketer to stop calling. They also strictly limit the number of abandoned or dead air calls that telemarketers can make within each calling campaign. On the other side, the revised rules also ensure that informational calls, such as those related to school closings, flight changes, continue to be available to consumers who wish to receive them. The Committee for U.S. International Broadcasting has blasted the recent Broadcasting Board of Governors budget proposals for fiscal year 2013 that we reported on last week. The committee said that it's outraged by the proposal to cut and reduce Voice of America English and foreign language programs and positions. It also takes issue with reductions to programs and positions at Radio Free Asia and at other U.S. government-funded international broadcasting entities managed by the Broadcasting Board of Governors. The Committee for U.S. International Broadcasting is a private, nonprofit interest group focused on broadcasting and news distribution. Its website is located in cyberspace at www.cusib.org. Some names in the news. Gary Pierce, KN4AQ, is releasing a series of videos shot at the Orlando Hamcation in mid-February. This is part of his Ham Radio Now series that features interviews with the true movers and shakers of the ham radio hobby in the 21st century. His latest release includes a very in-depth interview with CQ Magazine editor Rich Moseson, W2VU. In it, Pierce talks to him for almost an hour about how CW is faring now that it's no longer required, about the CQ family of magazines' new digital option, and a little about ham radio video production. This video is entitled Ham Radio Now, Episode 2, The Orlando Interviews. More about this new series is online at arvideonews.com. And the Wireless Institute of Australia Board has accepted the offer of Eric Jameson, VK5LP, to sponsor awards for first amateur radio contacts on the 2-meter band spanning the Indian Ocean between Australia and Africa. There will be 3 honors given, each one for voice, for CW, and for the digital modes. And as one might expect, this program will be known as the Eric Jameson Indian Ocean Awards. More on this is online now, www.wia.org.au. LightSquared, Inc., the wireless company whose controversial plans to operate in the spectrum adjacent to that used by the space-based GPS navigation system, says that it plans to lay off nearly half of its employees to save money. In a press release, the company said it'll cut 45% of its 330-employee workforce and called the move a necessary cost-saving measure to ensure the long-term success of the company. As previously reported, the Federal Communications Commission dealt the company a severe blow when it said it would revoke permission for LightSquared to move ahead with its wireless network. This after tests found that it would indeed interfere with global positioning systems used by the military, the airlines, and the general public. This is Ham Radio News for today's radio amateur. From the United States of America, we are the Amateur Radio Newsline, with links to the world from our only official website at www.arnewsline.org and being relayed by the volunteer services of the following radio amateur. Panasonic plans to release a new line of televisions in March with text-to-speech capabilities. This according to a podcast from the UK-based show Early Edition. On the netcast, Panasonic's Nigel Prackland is quoted as saying that users will be able to obtain channel information, browse the user's guide, and use the built-in electronic program guide, amongst other features. He went on to explain that the company felt it was the right time to include accessibility features, and that Panasonic planned to include it in all of its models. This based on the company stating that a user shouldn't be limited in the choice of television by which ones included accessibility features. Apple is credited in part for proving the technology could be added without much additional cost. This initial release of these new television sets appears to be targeted towards the UK market. No word on when these sets will be released worldwide. More information is now online at tinyurl.com/first-accessible-tv. 50 years of anticipation all worked out on the day that Australia and the world celebrated John Glenn's orbit in Friendship 7 over the city of Perth on Monday, February 20th. And ham radio was an important part of the event. Ono Benzchop, VK6FLAB, reports.
We had John Glenn, the Premier of WA, the Lord Mayor of Perth, Lynn Beasley, the WA Chief Scientist, and many other dignitaries on hand to celebrate. We even managed to squeeze in some David Bowie and a video on how to become an astronaut. The crowds filled the Northbridge Piazza and much anticipation culminated at 10:24 UTC. Orbital calculations all worked out and the International Space Station made it across the horizon. There were some chilling seconds when Mike was calling from Honolulu, but in the end the contact was a great success. Of course, an event like this could not have been possible without a little help from some friends. Captain Dan Burbank on the International Space Station, the WA State Records Office, the WA Museum, the City of Perth, ARIS, NASA, and the Hills Amateur Radio Group. A full credit list is being prepared on the Hills Amateur Radio Group website, but two people require a special mention. Tony, VK5ZAI, the Australian ARIS mentor, and Meg, VK6LUX, who energetically kept the multitude of interested parties moving along, making it all possible. We managed to get amateur radio into the news on ABC Online, ABC Radio, and local television. Who knows, we might pick up some more amateurs along the way. Alex, VK6FLOL, and Donald, VK6PDS, scored a place in history as prize winners for the contact. Perhaps you can help a local school in your area for an ARIS contact next year.
By way of background, on February 20th, 1962, John Glenn became the first American to orbit the Earth in the Friendship 7 spacecraft. On this mission, Glenn flew over Perth, and the people of Perth turned on their lights to acknowledge his mission. Glenn observed that the city was visible from space, and Perth became known worldwide as the City of Light. The RSGB reports that it's received an offer from the primary United Kingdom user of 5 megahertz, which is the Ministry of Defense aimed at working with the British ham radio community on band access issues. As has been reported earlier, the Ministry of Defense was unable to meet an RSGB request for access over a continuous range, but has offered a number of small frequency blocks. These include all of the present 3 kilohertz wide channels. The new offer is quite complex, with the RSGB's view is that it needs to seek input from members and non-members of the UK amateur community as to how it responds. As such, the RSGB announced that it would be launching what it calls a second litmus test discussion entitled New 5 MHz NOV Proposals. The details of the offer and the draft response from the RSGB should be uploaded to www.rsgb.org/consultations by March the 1st. On air, the Tuscaloosa Amateur Radio Club will be operating special event station W4XI on April the 28th from 11 a.m. till 5 p.m. local time. This is in remembrance of the 44 people that died when an F4 tornado struck that city on April the 27th in 2011. Operation will be from the top of the western parking deck at Druid City Hospital Regional Medical Center in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. The operating frequencies will be 7.270 and 14.270 megahertz, plus or minus any QRM. The club will also have a RIDI station in the data portion of both the 40 and 20 meter bands. QSL information is on the club website at www.w4kcq.org. The Irish Radio Transmitter Society is now celebrating its 80th anniversary and is on the air with a special call sign of EI80IRTS. An attractive certificate sponsored by Dundalk Amateur Radio Society will be available to all who make contact with the station. More details online at www.ei7dar.com/EI80IRTS.html. In DX, JI3DST will be on the air signing portable 9M2 from West Malaysia between 0000 on March the 10th and 0900 UTC on March the 11th. His activity will be on 80 through 6 meters, including most of the warp bands. Modes to be used will include CW, single sideband, and FM. You can QSL via JI3DST. DJ0IF and SP7VC will be on the air from Maldaria Island through the 7th of March, signing portable CT9. QSL via their home call signs. F6ITD will operate single sideband and digital modes on the HF bands from Guadalupe until March the 13th. QSL via his home call sign, either direct or via the Bureau. Lastly, K5LVU, VE7MID, VE7DS, and N5JR will be active from the Lutsane Safari Lodge in Botswana between March the 18th and the 27th. The group plans to be active in the CQ Worldwide WPX Single Sideband Contest from March 24th to the 25th as A25HQ. They'll have three stations in both a log periodic and wire antenna covering 160 meters and up. More details in future Amateur Radio Newsline reports. There was a time when IBM's mainframe computers were the cutting-edge machines for scientific and engineering calculations. Now, for NASA, that's all come to an end. Cheryl Lasek, K9BIK, has the details.
The day of the giant mainframe computer began in the 1960s when IBM System 360 rewrote the rules of computing and before humans walked on the moon. When NASA acquired two of the then SuperSpeed System 360 Model 95 mainframes in 1968, IBM touted the machine's mathematical abilities. But February marked the end of the era in NASA computing. This as the space agency powered down its last IBM Z9 mainframe that was located at Marshall Space Flight Center. Linda Curitan is a chief information officer who once programmed a System 360 mainframe in assembly language at the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. She is quoted as saying that mainframes are really not so bad, and they have their place. She notes that things like virtual machines, hypervisors, thin clients, and swapping are all old hat to the mainframe generation, though they are new to the current generation of what she termed as cyber youth. But for many in the industry, mainframes had become so burdened with a reputation for a bygone era of computing that they became synonymous with dinosaurs. To counter this, IBM fought back, boosting performance, adding new technology. The company succeeded in that these newer mainframe systems remain a fixture in some corners of the computing industry. In the old days, mainframes were the size of several large rooms. Today, these units are only the size of a refrigerator. And even though NASA has shut down its last one, there is still a requirement for mainframe capability in many other organizations. For the Amateur Radio Newsline, I'm Cheryl Lasek, K9BIK in Zion, Illinois.
By comparison with days gone by, today's fastest mainframe supercomputers can perform 10.5 quadrillion calculations per second. With thanks to Allen Labs, AMSAT, the ARRL, the CGC Communicator, CQ Magazine, the FCC, the Ohio Penn DX Bulletin, Radio Netherlands, RAIN, the RSGV, the Southgate News, and Australia's WIA News, that's all from the Amateur Radio Newsline. Our email address is newsline@arnewsline.org. More information is available at Amateur Radio Newsline's only official website, located at www.arnewsline.org. You can also write to us or support us at Amateur Radio Newsline, 28197 Robin Avenue, Santa Clarita, California, 91350. A reminder that the nominating period for the 2012 Amateur Radio Newsline Young Ham of the Year Award is now open. Full details and a downloadable nominating form are on our website at arnewsline.org/YHOTY. For now, with Bill Pasternak, WA6ITF at the editor's desk, I'm Jim Davis, W2JKD, saying 73 from Vero Beach, Florida. And we thank you for listening. Amateur Radio Newsline is copyright 2012. All rights are reserved.